This is Jim Sklavounis of Grinder Man, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
If you like music that's off the beaten path, and often off the beat, then tune in to Overlooked, the second and fourth Tuesday of the month, just after the noon news. You'll hear underplayed and overlooked music of all genres, continents, and omniverses. Overlooked on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Christoph of Freehold, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
The Catskill Food Pantry is located in the Parish Hall of St. Luke's Episcopal Church at 50 William Street in Catskill. The pantry is open to the public every Friday from 1 to 4 p.m. Healthy food is a right. For more information, please feel welcome to visit the pantry, call us at 551-299-2456, check the website at catskillfoodpantry.org, or connect with us on Facebook at Catskill Food Pantry.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In 2024, a ballot measure to throw out Ohio's dysfunctional, politician-led redistricting process had its description rewritten by state officials to sink it. Now, Ohio officials are trying to sink two more measures they don't like, and the U.S. Supreme Court is now involved. Some background. Ohio's fair and truthful ballot measure requirements allows the state to modify a ballot measure's description to make it more accurate for voters. But can it use that authority to manipulate the process and block citizens from moving their ballot measure forward? Organizers tried for 2 years to get the language okayed to gather signatures for the Protecting Ohioans' Constitutional Rights measure, giving citizens the private right to sue the state and removing the qualified immunity that police and government officials are currently given. While organizers have acted in good faith, Federal District Court Judge Karen Nelson Moore wrote that Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost rejected the proposed amendment language 8 times and found the reasons dubious. The 3-judge panel ruled 2-1 that Ohio was restricting organizers' speech and must approve the measure's description. But April 9th, Yost appealed to Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh for an emergency stay of the Sixth Circuit's order, which Kavanaugh immediately granted despite the sketchy circumstances. We'll continue to watch this situation. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
And using this Registration Act, asking that immigrants register, we are repeating a grave national error. We will see massive violations of human rights.
Angelica Salas with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights is one of many condemning President Donald Trump's use of the Alien Registration Act. As of April 11th, all undocumented immigrants have to register with the federal government within 30 days. The order is being challenged in court, though a federal judge is allowing it to go forward. Salas says it's asking people to sign up for mass deportations. This comes as the administration seems to be defying federal courts when sending migrants they claim are gang members to prison in El Salvador. A 60 Minutes investigation found 3/4 of those deported don't have criminal records. This includes Kilmar Abrego Garcia of Maryland, sent to El Salvador's notorious terrorism confinement center by mistake. The Supreme Court ruled the administration has to facilitate bringing him home, but Trump and the president of El Salvador say they won't bring him back. The migrants are being sent to El Salvador under an 18th century wartime law, which courts have said does not apply. States could face economic and fiscal problems from mass deportations. A new report from the Immigration Research Initiative and Connecticut Voices for Children found Connecticut could lose more than $400 million in tax revenue. Author David Disregard Kallick says entire industries could grind to a halt.
It's not just for the people who are working in the jobs where people who are undocumented tend to be concentrated and lowest at jobs, but you can't do the whole job unless you have those people there to do that. And so that would also mean job loss for the electricians, for the carpenters, for the architects, and for the construction companies.
Meanwhile, Trump Trump has signed a presidential memo aimed at preventing illegal aliens from receiving Social Security. Migrants without legal status virtually never collect Social Security, despite contributing more than $25 billion to the system each year. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says the new order will prevent waste and corruption.
It will expand the Social Security Administration's fraud prosecutor program to at least 50 U.S. attorney offices and establishes a Medicare and Medicaid fraud prosecution program in 15 U.S. attorney offices.
This comes after the Trump administration falsely listed 6,000 living immigrants as dead, saying that will enable the canceling of their Social Security numbers and could push them to, quote, self-deport. Leavitt says anyone who disagrees with the common sense policies of this administration can find a new job. Now that the U.S. House has passed the SAVE Act, civil rights groups say the effort to stop non-citizens from getting the ballot will stop legitimate voting. Lauren Groh-Wargo with Fair Fight Action says making people prove their citizenship could stop more than 20 million qualified Americans from voting.
There's other documents that you can provide, like your original birth certificate. But if your birth certificate changed because your name is no longer what you were born under, if you are a married woman, for example, and took your husband's name, that's not going to cut it.
Current federal law already requires voters to attest their citizenship under penalty of perjury, and illegal non-citizen voting almost never happens. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Navigating ships through the icy waters of the Canadian Arctic can be difficult and dangerous. But as the climate warms, Arctic ice is melting. So shipping companies are watching to see if the melting makes it easier to navigate through the region. But Jackie Dawson, an associate professor at the University of Ottawa who researches Arctic shipping, says the effects are complicated.
Despite the fact that we are seeing melting sea ice, what we're actually seeing is the breakup of big, huge ice islands and ice packs. And those smaller bits of ice are flowing, particularly into the Northwest Passage, and they're choking up those small regions that you have to get through.
All sorts of vessels, from fishing boats to yachts and oil tankers, can get stuck and stranded. And ships that supply food to remote communities may not be able to reach them.
A few years ago, we saw a few communities in the Western Canadian Arctic. The resupply ship just couldn't get to them. And what that meant was the food had to be flown in. And food prices in those communities were absolutely astronomical.
So she says that while melting sea ice is enabling more ship traffic overall, it's also making conditions in some areas more unreliable and dangerous. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
90.7 FM.
Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
You're listening to WGXC Acra, Radio for Open Ears. I'm Alana, your host. This is the WGXC Afternoon Show. I normally host There, which is on the first Tuesday of every month from 8 to 10 p.m. And I have two wonderful guests with me today from MPAC up in Troy, Leslie Suger and Tara Aisha Willis with the Ephemeral Organ Festival, which is coming up this week, this weekend. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit for some of our listeners who might not be so familiar with MPAC, the Experimental Media and Performing Arts Center at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Is where the arts, sciences, and technology meet under one roof and breathe the same air. Four exceptional venues enable audiences, artists, and researchers to inquire, experiment, develop, and experience the ever-changing relationship between our senses, technology, and the worlds we create around us. MPAC is an icon of the new polytechnic, a new paradigm for cross-disciplinary research and education at Rensselaer. And it opened in fall of 2008. For anyone who hasn't been up there, it's an incredible building, incredible facility, and they're doing incredible programming. It was, the New York Times called it the concert hall of the 21st century. So yeah, so it's exciting to have two representatives of this fine institution here with us on WGXC. And I'm just gonna first say, Tara, congratulations. I just read that you just received an official appointment at MPAC. Which is very cool. You are now the curator of theater and dance. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I've been sort of a curator in residence for a year, which is why this festival is happening right now, as soon as, you know, sort of right after my appointment announcement. But yes, they moved me to full time in the last couple of weeks. It's very exciting.
So exciting. That's wonderful. And will you be living full time up in Troy, or
Yeah, good question. My family is
you know, in Chicago.
My family's in Chicago. I was curator of performance at the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago for several years. And so they will still be there. And so I'll be splitting time, but I'm really looking forward to being like grounded in Troy. It's been such a joy and pleasure to be here off and on over the last year. And I spent 12 years in New York City and spent a fair amount of time upstate at various residencies and whatnot as a dancer myself. So yeah, I'm really excited to sort of be in the Hudson Valley region and in the capital region a lot more often. Yeah, it's a really exciting network of artists that are out here.
Oh yeah, yeah. And it's, so it sounds like it's sort of familiar territory, the terrain of this place. And
absolutely.
All sort of different towns and facets, and it's yeah, it's a fascinating place. I've been in the area for about 12 years, I think. That's right. And it's always has new surprises. There's always like new things I'm learning about different communities within the region and different towns. And every town kind of has its own personality. And I love Troy. I think it's a great place. I'm in the Kingston area, but I sometimes fantasize about a parallel life living in Troy. One of my weird fantasies.
But yeah, Kingston is lovely.
When you travel somewhere, you fantasize like how it would be to live there.
Yeah.
So I think about Troy. Maybe when I'm an older person, you know, that'll be my like retirement home or something.
I love that for you.
Anyway, so I'm just going to read part of your bio. This is the one from the MPAC website. Before joining MPAC, Tara Aisha Willis served as performance curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago, taught at the University of Chicago, and developed programs at Movement Research. She's been awarded research fellowships from the Getty Research Institute, the University of London, Indiana University Bloomington, Jacob's Pillow, and the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. Her writing has appeared in publications including Center, Dance Based Project, Center for Book Arts, Liquid Blackness, MCA Chicago, The Black Scholar, Women and Performance, Performance Research, and The Brooklyn Whale, with work forthcoming from the University of Illinois Press. She's also co-edited artist books with Wendy Subway and soon Sober's Cove Press. So clearly MPAC is very lucky to have you as part of their permanent staff. And yeah, maybe we could start a little bit just talking about the festival, Ephemeral Organ Festival, which is happening now, and how you came to work on that and what was sort of the seed of inspiration for that festival.
Yeah, I when I think about curating work, you know, groupings of artists together and thinking about through lines and questions that might kind of hold a set of projects together for an audience, it often blooms out of questions that I have in my own academic and creative research. Excuse me. And one of the things that has come up again and again in some of my writing and in how I'm in conversation with artists in the last several years is really about archives and history and sort of how artists either directly grapple with the materials of the past, whether that's physically old photographs and videos and, you know, ephemera, you know, this is where the title comes from, various things that kind of emerge around an event that is in the past, or whether that's just the material of like their dance training, you know, that they had as a child or as a young person or, you know, going to parties growing up, and sort of how those things manifest in the present. And that literally for me in my research means that I'm digging through archives sometimes and thinking about how dance is documented in these very practical ways. But also it means that I'm thinking about how artists, you know, may not be well documented because they're working in dance. You know, dance is very hard to sort of capture and hold in these ways that make them legible later on. And then, of course, there are gaps in who is captured and understood as part of history and as an important sort of facet of that past, which I think Leslie's project speaks to really beautifully, especially in the set of projects in the festival. So it started from that larger question. And, you know, I try to ask that question in my writing, but I also try to ask that question through my curatorial work and look around for the artists who are asking similar questions in different ways. And so I think each artist, even though they're really wide ranging in terms of, how they're doing that, how they're asking that question, I think there is a real picture that gets painted when they're all brought together and in conversation with each other, hopefully, or at least not literally in conversation with each other, but like as an audience member, how you might view the projects in conversation with each other. So hopefully it coheres for folks. And I think that MPAC will also be thinking in this sort of festival through line thematic way quite a bit more often going forward, not just in dance, but also in music and in time-based visual art. You know, I think it really does tell a story, you know, for an audience. And it also gives artists something to sort of latch onto in how they're growing their work, you know, if it's in development or if it's already existed, like Leslie's project did, had already premiered. But it's a really beautiful way to kind of open a door onto the work and allow it to kind of blossom. Hopefully it's done that.
I totally love it. I love the festival vibe, and I can totally see it sort of igniting even more. I mean, I'm sure attendance there is probably pretty good. I couldn't say I know. I'm sure I could see it igniting even more enthusiasm and just energy coming into the space, which is exciting. And, you know, I loved what you were saying about the documentation of dance, because I realized it's something that I, you know, I come from a little bit of a performance background, but not really well-versed in contemporary dance at all. And thinking about how people document and how people write about it is something that's really interesting. You know, I have sort of an orientation from avant-garde theater, and you know, I was sort of thinking about what are the sort of intersection points, because I know that there's a lot of cross-pollination between theater and dance, especially in the contemporary world, but how people talk about it and write about it, I'm sure really has a profound impact on how people, you know, engage with it, how people move through it as audience members and performers. And so it's a really interesting world, and it's exciting to me that you're thinking about wanting to put a little more focus on how it's documented, aside from, you know, video or, right, you know, bad videos from performances that nobody wants to stare, or, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, except for scholars like me want to stare at that.
Right, of course you probably want to see all the bad videos from every... every dance performance.
Totally. I mean, I think in addition to the content and form of the works and the talks in the festival, grappling with some of these questions, you know, I very intentionally invited two artists, a writer and an artist writer, Jonathan Gonzalez and Julia Elizabeth Neal, who's an art history scholar, to be sort of in-house writers at the festival. And we don't know where that writing will go or land afterwards, but I think it was just important to kind of budget for having documentation not just happen in the way that MPAC always does documentation, which is amazing, which is like mm-hmm. four mm-hmm. camera shoots, you know, right, run by robots or whatever, right? Because it's MPAC.
That's awesome.
But, you know, and so those videos won't be grainy and awkward to watch. They'll be lovely. But I do think writing, you know, dance and theater are very tricky to document. Sometimes theater has a script, sometimes dance has a kind of score of some kind or instructional structure that you can refer back to. But there's, you know, the more methods of documentation that can happen, the more the dance is present. And also it points to the beautiful, intentional places that you can't, you know, recreate the dance, the moments that can't be felt after it was felt with an audience in the room. And so I think, you know, writing is extremely biased always, mm-hmm. in my opinion,
yes.
but it does provide something that sometimes video can't, and vice versa. So it was an intentional choice to think along those lines in inviting those two writers in.
It's a very cool idea to have a sort of a writer assigned to, you know, as like a general practice of, you know, you put on a show and you have to have your writer documenting, not just your photographer or whoever else, videographer. That's very cool. Well, I look forward to seeing how it unfolds. And maybe as a nice segue into Leslie's work, we could talk about the festival. I know that the festival started last fall. You did a little bit of public work around that. So how did that open, I guess, or how did it start?
Yeah, it's always tricky when you're trying to really make sure that dance is present across a season and also hold a festival. So, you know, the series Ephemeral Organ really technically started in the fall, but this, you know, 2 days of performances and talks is kind of the culmination and maybe the close. We'll see, you know, where that documentation lands, like we were saying. But in the fall, we had a few different residencies that were part of the festival. we had Stephanie Jemison in residency, and we had Catherine Simone Reynolds and AJ McLennan in residency. Stephanie will do a talk about the work she's developing, and then Catherine and AJ will do a sort of sketch of a performance they're hoping to develop further, which also has an installation element that people can view, even when they're not physically moving through it. And then we had Shawnee McElaine Holloway, who's a fabulous artist and maybe the most in spirit of MPAC in the sense that she's working very deliberately with computers and mm-hmm. the digital and how gesture and objects in a space and a performer in a space can interface with that kind of sort of data in conversation. So, you know, Shawnee did a residency, but she also did a beautiful talk and a sort of sample of a performance that she had been developing in the residency. And so hopefully at some point that video will be available somewhere. We'll see. I know Shawnee has a sort of online platform that she tends to put her performance documentation on. It's just a question of when. So if you search for her, you may find it in the next year on Google or wherever, you know. And then I also did a talk, which was sort of an opening, you know, on the topic of ephemeral organ as a festival, but also on research in general and my curatorial work in the past and how I think about bringing artists together in a building, essentially, you know, for lack of a better way of framing it. So the festival, those two talks happen in the fall, and now we get, you know, two performance works, one of which is also an installation, and two talks on performance works, which, you know, and that's going to be a dense little moment, you know, in a couple of days. And, you know, hopefully we'll all eat food together too. And, yeah, you know, those things fun. That festivals include. Yeah. So
glue or whatever.
Exactly. And maybe one day some of that writing will come out in some other form and the festival will continue.
And if folks would like to look for that talk that you gave last fall, is it easy to find online right now?
That is a great question. I'm going to go find out when I get to the office, actually. I think it will be at some point soon. Maybe I can nudge them to try to make that happen before the festival. Yeah.
I'm sure you'll be speaking to people there as well, but, you know, to have that as a reference point is cool. It sounds like, I don't know, it just sounds super fun. If we'll get back to this again at the end, but if anyone is like, oh, I need to go book a ticket right now for this festival, where just go to the MPAC website. Is that the best way to do it?
Yeah, that's definitely it. It should come up pretty immediately on there or near the top. Yeah. So yeah, ephemeral organ.
Cool. And you know, it's fun. I think of that building as sort of, I don't know it intimately, but it is sort of like a big robot or something. So the idea of sort of putting like human breath inside of it, this sort of giant, not like a Death Star, that's a terrible, terrible metaphor, but like, you know, this big metal thing, you know, and
yeah, or industrial spaceship thing. Maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is spaceship. Definitely like something has landed on the hillside. Yeah. There, you know.
So I love the idea of there's this breathing organ inside it, you know, that's has all these different facets to it. Is
I think that's what, you know, performance can do, is really turn you know, what would otherwise be very brick and mortar, you know, type of space into something else entirely. And that's, you know, every time I walk into a theater, I love a gallery, I love a house or a, you know, a park, but there's something about a theater, you know, whether it's a black box or a big concert hall or whatever, that always, you know, just feels a bit magical and real in a way, you know, even though it's all about illusion and all these tricks, you know, that you can play in the theater. But there is something incredibly potent and like changeable about it and surprising, you know, always. Mm. And I feel that even when it's empty, when there's no performers in there. So I hope people can feel that too.
Yeah. And permission to kind of exist in another reality or, you know, possibility. So maybe that's a good segue. Now I'm going to read Leslie's bio, but I have this stack of paper. So bear with me for one moment. Here we go. Leslie Suger is an award-winning performer and choreographer. Her dances often integrate text, video, and live performance while interrogating the performing body, personal legacy, and dance history. Mostly known as a performer, she is also a writer and editor, as well as a co-founder of the Authentic Movement Collective, Duvet, which all play an ongoing role in shaping her interdisciplinary artistic practice. Her tenure in New York is decorated with performances and collaborations with Jane Comfort, Cynthia Oliver, Niall Jones, Yanira Castro, Will Rawls, David Gordon, Narcisse Sister, and Kim Brandt, among others. Suger's work has been presented at The Kitchen, The Shed, MoMA PS1, The Chocolate Factory, and Center for Performance Research. Recent honors include Foundation for Contemporary Arts Grants for Artists, Princeton Hodder Fellowship, and an outstanding Choreographer Creator Bessie Award for her 2021 work, Blur. Welcome, Leslie. Welcome to the Hudson Valley and to WGXE, the WGXE airwaves.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you're going to be sort of, I guess headlining is maybe not a fair way to put it, but are you headlining this festival?
I suppose. Yes.
As of today, you know.
Right.
In this conversation, you're the headliner of the but I would love to hear, I know that you did a version of your project at the Kitchen, which for anyone who doesn't know is a legendary performance space in New York City. Yeah, I'd love to hear just how that, what was the seed of the project, how did it start, and how did you, you know, begin there?
Sure. The project was really a result of, it started as my research that I was doing in a program that they call Dance and Process. It's one of their longest running series where they curate a group of a small cohort of 3 to 4 artists that sort of put together a critical 10-week practice and forming their process and a new work. They really encourage experimental formula and formation of what performance work can be. And after the second session, it was interrupted by the pandemic. And instead of meeting in person and performing live works for each other every week, we were shifted to sort of like an online practice like everybody else was. And from having the big black box of the kitchen to work in was reduced to my living room. And I started engaging in a writing practice. I was taking an online course in Adobe Premiere. I was, you know, doing a lot of things. I was going through my archive. I was, you know, kind of trolling through hard drives and artifacts. And really, it started to, you know, we were kind of looking at the limited amount of resources that we had. And for me, that was this digital archive on my hard drive and these objects on my desk. And one of which was this portrait of my great aunt, Marion Suger, who years and years ago, I started this, you know, kind of campaign to kind of rewrite her into dance history because she played such an important role in the legacy of a lot of prominent dancers, and felt like I just had her obituary and a thesis written by former graduate student at Temple University to kind of like go off of. That was pretty much all the information I had. And it really started as a street commemoration project for one of her studios in downtown Philadelphia on Walnut Street. And that proved to be very difficult because there's a lot of historical buffs in Philadelphia, and there's a lot of it's a deep process. And so I've always wanted to kind of like commemorate her contribution to not just my life and my family legacy, but dance history. And so I started kind of putting together, like I said, working with the resources I had, little notes and writing and gestures, movement gestures that I could do pretty much in my living room. And it kind of was blending in with this long-time research that I had about being a performer for so long in so many people's work and not really having control of how my body is viewed as a performer, not really having the agency to kind of write my own visual landscape, even though it was my body. And so The Kitchen is incredibly generous with their resources. And I, you know, started off with one projector once we got access to the theater to work in a space. And then I asked for two projectors, and then pretty soon I had seven projectors and a video artist to work with. And it kind of, I formed this idea of having control of what the audience was able to see through the lens of a live feed camera, and pretty much having control over this meditative research that I was going through with these videos and these objects.
Wow.
So that's kind of like the long story of like a lot of research that was going on over many years, but kind of culminated into this long, what was supposed to be a 10-week process and turned into almost like a year and a half of research.
Really beautiful thinking about, you know, I know so many people during the pandemic were, you know, confined to these spaces and trying to find ways to be creative and to work. And I love the idea of it being not just, oh, that was the result, but that it was like an incubator for you to kind of mine something different and then have it be able to have it expand out into all kinds of other spaces is really, I don't know. It just makes it seem less like, oh, we just survived through a terrible thing, and more that, oh, there was like something really fruitful, and not that it's even over, but you know, that period of time.
Absolutely.
Cool. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about your aunt, great aunt. I'm sorry, aunt or great aunt.
Yes, Marion Suger. She was a, I should know this by now. she was a pioneer in dance education as a result of being a former student of ballet and a performer herself. She was also very fair skinned and sort of moved into dance education and away from performing because she was encouraged by her mentor to dance in a company where she passed. So she was passing as a white performer and was, I'm using bunny ears here, found out and caught and was ejected from this ballet school, and then kind of turned to education to kind of create a space for other dancers who might not have access to the same sort of privilege she did because of her skin. And this is sort of my retelling of her story. There are many other prominent pillars in her career, but this was the thing that I kind of grabbed onto, was this idea of her kind of grappling with that privilege and turning it into this sort of amazing resource that her school was called the Judimar School, and she had Judith Jameson, I remember, wrote in her autobiography a chapter on Marion Suger, and when I was a kid I read that, and it was so amazing to see this, my name, you know, my last name, mm-hmm. in this book to one of my idols as a kid. And just the fact that, like, nobody, I don't know how many people knew that story. So I guess that's it.
Exciting. And so you have, you're sort of making decisions about what parts of her to share through this piece, or what the, I mean, is it, I know there's, you're working physically, so you have video documentation, and you have, I'm assuming, sound and, you know, other visual elements. But would you say that the physical embodiment that you're doing as a performer is a big part of how you're communicating her story?
I'm really looking at some of those things that stood out to me in her life through this, through my own research and talking with family members and her granddaughters and other people who knew her. Some people I know who taken class with her would, you know, say she had the, like, the cigarette and the cane, and didn't take any slack. And so there are some things about, like, discipline, privilege, about decorum, being proper, all those things that sort of I felt akin to, because that's how I was also brought up. And so it's sort of like my translation of those things in my body that I've sort of investigated it, how they show up in my own life. And that's how I feel like I'm paying homage to those, what I'm gleaning of these attributes or the characteristics of her life, and sort of like interpreting them through my own body and my own experiences. So I realized recently I was looking at some of the writing. There's a writing piece that accompanies the performance work, and there's so much that has to do with my mother. And it, I think it is about this like passing down of legacy and set of behaviors and just what's, you know, what I would call home training that is sort of built into the legacy of especially black women. That I'm sort of equating with the research that I've done with Marian's life and Marian's upbringing.
And is this your first time working with video in a major way, or has that always been a component of your work?
Yeah, I've worked with video a lot. I've done some exclusive video installations, and I've had a lot of projection in my work, but I was really curious about how else video can be present in live performance other than just a recorded projection. And like I said, I was fortunate enough to work with the kitchen, who was very open and generous with their resources, and got connected to a video artist who was able to, you know, work with me when I didn't have the language for video design. I'm like, what would it look like if I, you know, created a loop from a live feed and was able to control that and where that went and how it was viewed? And he kind of shrugged and was like, yeah, no problem. It's like, oh,
done.
and so it kind of introduced this new way of working with live and recorded video, and sort of like, and it also, again, like feeding my research as a performer and wanting to kind of step back or control how I'm being viewed. I wanted to step more into like the role of a technician and a performer. So I get to be subject, but I also am controlling all of the video and making choices live as a designer, as an artist. So it was really exciting for me to have video be the medium in this new way, rather than just like a backdrop or something to interact with or installed in a specific setting.
I can imagine that feeling is very liberating as a performer, to be able to have that kind of power that you're not used to having, you know, manipulating the event on a whole other
level. Totally. And as the project grew, I that was like a goal or a rule I set for myself, was like, I wanted to be totally self-sufficient. But as it grew, working with the amazing team of designers that helped me build this piece, I realized that there were some things that it would just be too much for me to control. But yeah, it's mostly my triggering of all the video.
And now that it's at MPAC, how is it transforming, or what's the new kind of task at hand to sort of make it come alive in this new space?
I'm used to, as a dancer, wearing many hats, especially as an independent artist. I came in with an idea, and the kitchen was able to pull it together as best we could, especially they're in a temporary performance home as their original location is under construction right now. So this was not even in a traditional performance space, so they were with a lot of limited technical theatrical resources. And now that I'm able to be at MPAC with incredible resources and in a theater, I'm just so excited to actually build the set with actual designers and like actually have the structure sort of be considered in this way, that without the restraints of the space, and actually be able to be its fully formed self with the team of incredible people that have just said, maybe we should do it this way. And I was like, yeah, that makes so much more sense. And just having the flexibility of working with their team and like, yeah, all the, and we couldn't even like hang more than like three lights before. So now it's just, wow, really exciting.
Very different. Yeah, and the same. But I'll just add, you know, for anyone that has been to MPAC before, it's in the theater. But, you know, because it was in a kind of white room, gallery type room before, the theater is being used in a very different way, in case that's enticing. You will not be sitting in the seats in the house. So you will be on stage yourself. And all of that kind of thing. So, you know, there's something also about a big black room that is very different than the type of space it was in before. And I think the lighting designer, especially, as well as the video designer, are, you know, they're both really thinking about how to adapt this work for that. You know, it's like the void surrounds the piece in a different way, you know, the dark void rather than this kind of white expanse of a space. So so that's been really exciting for me as a curator to just be listening in on that conversation about how to make Leslie show up and the video, you know, that Leslie is controlling sort of show up differently in this space.
That's wonderful. I'm curious how the two of you became aware of each other's work, because you're both not only performers but scholars and writers. And how did that connection happen?
That's a great question. I don't know what your version of that story is, but Leslie, I have a really specific memory of you like rushing into a rehearsal at the kitchen, actually, for Kim Brandt, a choreographer that we were both working with, like at the very beginning of her sort of practice exploding and becoming larger. She was working with a large group of people for the first time, and we were both in that group. And I think you were like wearing a suit jacket or something, or you had come from like a office gig of some kind. And I was just like, I know who that person is, but like, I'd never worked with you before and like, didn't really know you. And I just remember being like, she knows what this business is about. Like, she's like, got her office job.
You know? I don't think I've heard that story.
Yeah, I just remembered it while I was like pondering this question. And I think at that point you were also really considering like diving sort of headfirst into your choreographic practice. You had been a performer for a lot of people, and so I'm sure I had seen you perform. You know, but I think that project is probably the first time I remember actually like officially meeting you and working with you as co-performers. And we've done that again, you know, since then. But I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, my first knowledge of you is through movement research. Mm-hmm. And just like that was before I sort of like was getting into the community there. And I knew that you were a prominent figure and and also a performer as well. And so yeah, like I think that was the first time that our paths kind of like crossed in the studio, but then it sort of like merged. I mean, the thing that's sort of overwhelming was just like our years touring with Will Rawls together and working on his piece What Remains, that was I came in later in the process, but it was still such a intense and beautiful and generative time. It was, we toured for over a year and a half.
Yeah, I think that with you, we did one show before in 2017, maybe. And then in 2018, we premiered it with you and toured it through 2019 and then COVID. And in 2021, we rebooted it as well. Yeah. So it was really this long durational, like, yeah, gosh, that's like 4 years, even though there was like a year and a half gap in there, you know?
Yeah. And that was also, you know, you were researching your dissertation at the time. And so I was really sort of aware of what Tara was sort of investigating and researching and really considering deeply, because that process and her practice was so, you know, I was a part of it. I was a part of that whole part of that research. So yeah, I've been kind of like sort of on the periphery, but also very intimate with Tara's mind and her work. And also Tara brought Kim Brandt again to MCA Chicago, and I was also performing with Kim for that. So we've had many sort of overlappings as colleagues and over the years. So this is the first time we've been in this sort of relationship, but it's been a pleasure, and it feels really really comfortable. It feels really natural. Yeah.
It's easy when you, it's hard work producing shows, but it's easier when you have a sort of relationship, you know, you can kind of just enter the conversation and talk about the stuff, the creative side and the like logistical budgetary side fairly frankly, you know, because you have a rapport. And it's always really wonderful when I can do that with artists, and it's like, we know we're like, all the info is being shared. It's not like a weird dynamic, you know, even though we have this other set of relationships and collaborations in the past. And yeah, to that point about the dissertation, I'm still working on turning that text into a book, actually. So I'm like with Leslie all the time in my brain, you know, and the other performers as well. But, you know, it's just like, there's so much description to our conversation earlier about documentation. You know, there's so much description that goes into writing about dance, and especially because I happen to love writing description of dance, you know, there's just a lot of it. And so I have spent a lot of hours like watching videos of us dancing together and writing about it and editing that writing and revising and whatever. So it's a continual, I think, even if we're not literally working together at a given moment, I feel like we've been working together for almost 10 years maybe or something, you know? So, it's an amazing thing to have all these different facets to a practice and to a shared conversation.
It's an interesting kind of intimacy to be sort of, you know, getting to know someone more deeply through a video image of either them or yourself with them is cool. Just like layers and layers of that to draw on is really neat. Yeah. What was I going to ask? Oh, you know, I'm making the assumption that you both started as performers of dance before you started thinking about scholarship and writing about it. Am I correct in that assumption?
Leslie, why don't you answer that first?
Well, for me, that's true. That's my background in dance. I've been training pretty much all my life. And it wasn't until I think it was around 2016 that I decided to kind of start making my own work. And I feel like only in the last 4 or 5 years, I've really started to develop what I would call a body of work. So it still feels like a recent shift for me to start thinking about, again, like, and as you read in my bio, which I kind of forgotten, I put in there was like this research of the performing body, because a lot of my experience, a lot of my career was kind of built around being this vessel, this you know, with technical ability, with a fluency in different sorts of modes of performing, and I really started to interrogate that in 2016, but when I started making my own work. But then again, as through the pandemic, it sort of morphed into other forms like writing and collage and sculpture and all these and video. And so I hadn't really considered it a scholarly practice, but it definitely sort of this interrogation and deep investigation of like blending all these different aspects of history and legacy and race and privilege sort of were just at the forefront of my mind all the time. And I just sort of kind of formalized it into a creative practice.
And it'll be exciting to see where it evolves to, you know,
as you
work, you know, because now that you've done it, I'm sure, you know, there's just like a whole other level of richness to how you're approaching things and,
mm-hmm.
Or not, or maybe you'll get sick of that and want to go back to something completely different.
I keep waiting to find something different, and it just keeps it keeps holding my interest. So
But I will say, for the performance happening in the festival with Marion, there will be, the audience will receive like some beautiful writing of Leslie's at the door. So it's also like all the things are happening at once.
Yeah.
And how about you? I guess that's maybe a longer story.
Well, I don't know if it's longer. It's just a little bit different. I mean, as a child, was a writer first, actually. Yeah, I was like a little poet, you know, and language was always, I mean, I was just nose in a book constantly. And then I found dance. I mean, I grew up in a very performing arts oriented, musically oriented household. And so dance, you know, was supported and being involved in theater and all that stuff. And so, you know, but I chose dance really first as like my thing that was mine and writing alongside each other. And so at some point I realized you could write about dance. I hadn't thought of that before, you know, as a sort of young adult, and found out there was this thing called dance studies and performance studies, and you could theorize and think in this academic way also. And so, I don't know, I think they've been alongside each other for me the whole time. I just, one or the other might toggle more into focus. And sometimes because the writing side is attached to the types of jobs that take up a lot of space in your life, like being a full-time curator or being in academia, you know, like there is a kind of precedent that it can sometimes take. And I have to fight a little bit hard to to keep dance present, which I'm currently working on doing, you know, even as I work at MPAC, which is, you know, a wonderful thing about MPAC. They really, I think, understand that multifacetedness. But to me, they're very connected. Like, I can't write the way I do about dance without having done the dancing. Not that I only write about things I was in or something, though I do in the case of that chapter on Will Rawls's project. But it is, you know, I think it adds my familiarity with the practice and my capacity to imagine my own body in the situation of the bodies I'm writing about, based on experience, is maybe heightened because of my dance practice, and to test out ideas in my own body, for example, that kind of thing. I think it really helps with my writing. And in fact, I know Will has said that he invited me into that project partly because of my writing, not because he expected me to write about it, but just because it was a piece that involved a lot of poetry and speaking and utterance. And so, you know, to have someone who was like facile in that way. I mean, Leslie, you're an incredible performer with text in a way that I can only hope to achieve. But there is like a theorizing of voice and text that I bring into the room, I think, that he was drawn to, you know. So it's like we all were showing up into that project for those different capacities. And in my ideal world, like I can, you know, bring all of my practices together in these different moments in these different ways.
Well, Tara, I don't know if you feel this way also, but like when I started developing a writing practice, I was like so aware immediately about how it felt so familiar to like a choreographic practice, like making choices. It was an embodied experience for me. You don't know where you're going. It is like kind of this, the same experience of kind of walking into an empty studio is like for me looking at a blank page. And I find the marriage of those two really, you know, like ripe with opportunity and possibility in the same way as like, and the act of reading, right? Mm-hmm. The act of reading is like how I watch a performance. So totally, it really feels like they are in the same conversation for sure. So that, I don't know.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. That's a really good reminder, because I do believe that. I do experience them very similarly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because we're asked to write in so many different sets, you know, for grants and for like emails and whatever, you know, there's a way that it can sometimes seep into the center for me. But it is true. They hit the same desire inside of me, whether I'm witnessing or generating, you know? And so, yeah, to draw on that same feeling that I get from composing a great like paragraph,
right?
To compose a sequence of events in a studio.
It hits the same way.
It does. It really does. It's true. Yeah. They maybe have slightly different relationships to time, but the reality of making is that you are like jumping around in time all the time. And there is a sequentialness to how things unfold in a page and how things unfold in a theater, you know? And so, yeah, it's very similar, very similar.
You're bending my brain right now. This is kind of amazing. To think about it, I was thinking about sci-fi. You know, there's all these sci-fi stories where people are sort of imagining in the future that they leave their bodies, but they have this other existence, you know, beyond or chosen, you know. And I can just see like the idea of writing and thinking as being a physical act. And it's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I do, especially with this piece, as Tara mentioned, like it's on the stage, it's in the audience is on stage and they have actually the freedom to walk around and to experience how they need to experience. And I that's part of, like, I think what my authentic movement practice has taught me is, like, the experience of watching a performance or watching dance or looking at any art, I think is extremely personal, and it can take you to an outer body experience, but it also can, you know, distract you from making your grocery list or whatever you need to be thinking about. And all of that is correct and all of that is present. And the fact that this sort of manipulation of live feed video and this whatever, these little choreographies that I'm doing with these objects or my body, it really is to create sort of, I think it Tara put in her writing, like a meditative experience to just kind of like be with me, with Marion, in the space and have your own individual experience.
Hmm. Are you, Tara, going to be performing any time that you can envision? I don't know where you're going to find time to do that, but, you know.
That's a great question. I do have a small studio showing in LA. So that doesn't help anybody in Hudson Valley unless you're also bi-coastal. But yeah, I'm currently on a fellowship, a postdoctoral fellowship at the Getty Research Institute. And so a friend and I have just planned just, you know, sort of work in progress, get some things in front of some friends kind of thing. And then I have a duet with my partner, Damon Locks, who's a musician and visual artist. And we are working on bringing that to Chicago. We've done it in New York a couple times, actually, in sort of DIY.
I've seen it. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we did it at Come On Everybody, which is like a bar in Brooklyn. And nice. We did it at the Poetry Project at St. Mark's Church. You know, so we're hopefully it'll get to expand a bit. We're currently working on finding residency space for that. So
it
shouldn't be too hard if I'm based largely in the Hudson Valley. There's a million residencies out there. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. And you'll have your hands full, but I'm happy to hear that you're both things, all those elements are evolving. It'll be fun to continue to follow and see what you're doing next. I think maybe this is a good time to tell people who are listening, if they want to learn more about both of your work, what are there any like websites or other things you'd like to share that people could visit to learn more?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. I have a website, lesliesujet.com, which I think is linked on the MPAC page, possibly.
Yes, and I think also on the WGXC broadcast list.
Okay.
If anyone wants to check the archive there, you can always go to WGXC.org and look for the broadcast archive, and you should be able to find it that way as well.
Awesome. Mine is TaraAishaWillis.com, and of course the Ephemeral Organ webpage on the MPAC website. Yeah, those are your best bets.
Awesome. And what are the exact times and dates of the, it's 2 days of programming, right?
Yeah. The festival is April 17th and 18th. That's Thursday, Friday before Easter. There are basically everything is between 3 and 9 p.m. The installation project is running kind of 3 to 8 both days, though there are intermittent performances on Thursday, which I highly recommend. And there will be a talk on Thursday and another talk on Friday, both at 5:30. And then Leslie's performances are before and after that talk on Friday. Sorry, this is a little awkward to give a schedule over audio, but
sure. No one will remember, but no. Look, we're planting.
But you never know. Someone might be like, "Ooh, I could totally go to that." You know, and right. So Leslie's performances are on Friday. Both, there's two performances. The first one is, I want to say, at 4 p.m. And the second one is at 8 p.m. So you have multiple choices.
Excellent. Well, I just want to thank both of you for taking the time to talk with me. It's been really fun talking with both of you. And this will be in the archive.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, have fun getting the show together.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Here we go.
You're in the crunch time, I'm sure.
So. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And nice meeting you.
Thanks, Alana. Pleasure.
Bye.